The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. Michael is an international business lawyer and consultant who has also been the CEO of three international companies. Michael has also written three books, one of which is about how Nelson Mandela realized his own dreams to become an iconic winner who saved a nation. In today's show, join Michael in a conversation with his guest, a winner who has also made a difference for the better in the lives of those he or she has touched. Michael and his guest will offer some insight that might well help you realize your own dreams. Now, here is your host, Michael Friedlander.
Well, I am Michael Friedlander, and welcome to our show. For some reason that's totally inexplicable to me, people seem to want to listen to Steve Burrows and me in conversation. Not necessarily me, but Steve. So I am delighted to welcome you back, Steve, to the show. I have to say the only reason to have these shows is it's an excuse for us to talk. I don't think we've spoken as much since these shows started as we did before.
No, that's true. It's good.
So I think I should make this disclosure. We were talking about the topic for the show, and I suggested that we should be focused and try and nail it down to a few things. You said being focused is never a good idea, and that we seem to be working better together when we're just sort of winging it. You know, I think you're probably right. The topic you suggested for the show today was leadership, management, and organization to get the best out of people. I thought we should throw in curing cancer and world poverty, but I thought there may not be enough time for that. But I tend to think we should call today's show something like that motivation thing, how to get the best out of people. And I think that we'll cover everything that we wanted to cover, including cure for cancer, maybe.
And world peace.
World peace, absolutely. Yeah. And not the basketball player, just generally world peace, yeah.
Okay.
Incidentally, before we do get going, I have to say how much we both enjoy one another's senses of humor. I don't know if there's a soul out there who laughs when we do, but at least we're having a good time. Okay, so let's get going. I've just finished reading a book on motivation called Drive by Daniel Pink, who was talking about outdated modes of motivation and how business had lagged behind the latest theories of motivation. And one of the things he said is that management isn't the solution, it's the problem. And his argument is that management can sometimes be so controlling that they stifle the creative juices, if you like, of those they're trying to motivate. And I thought that might be a really good place to start, because he says that the traditional views of management is that management is all about control and it's all about direction, and it moves from a premise that in order to get people moving, I suppose, you need a prong to get them going. And absent a reward or punishment, people will just stay in place. And that once we then get moving, we need direction. And his comment to that was really, really, he doesn't think that's really the case. So let's start there. What do you think?
I mean, the way I look at leadership and management is it's like driving a car. So, you know, management is the rearview mirror. So everything you get, financial accounts, whatever it might be, it all looks backwards. So it tells you what happened yesterday. And leadership is about looking through the windshield and looking forward and thinking about what's coming ahead. And you need both. You've got to have both to drive the car safely. But I think, you know, Daniel Pink's argument is that the way businesses were run, the way people were actually managed in the past, was a bit carrot and stick. And I think to some extent it still is, that people are given things like a bonus is dangled out there. You know, if you achieve your financial targets, you will get a bonus. And then the stick is, and if you don't, you won't, or worse. And so there's a belief that people will you know, looking at that bonus that's around the corner 6 or 8 months ahead, they'll chase after it and it will motivate them to achieve something. And I just don't believe that's the case. I don't think people sit at their in their offices or at their work for a whole year dreaming about the bonus. I don't think that's the right approach. And I think we've sort of got mixed up in that over the course of a long period of time. You know, maybe one day that was true, but I don't think it's true anymore.
Well, that's exactly what he says. He talks about two types of personalities. He talks about type X and type I. Type X, he calls those who are motivated by external rewards or extrinsic rewards. And that if they're given something or they are threatened with something, they will react. And he then compares those people with type I, which are intrinsic folks. For them, the motivator is being free and challenged, and they like the process of getting something done. And what he also does is he says there's a difference between creative tasks and sort of automated tasks. And for the creative people, intrinsic motivation is all that works. Not that money isn't important to them, it is. But once the money issue is behind them, what turns them on is the process and what they're actually doing. And generally, the type I's outperform the type X's. And he said the key for management is to try and understand that and not put a block, if you like, on the type I's.
Yeah, I mean, I have a pretty simple philosophy of what motivates people to be successful. I mean, first of all, if you look at me, you know, how can I do my job best? I think if the people who are part of the business that I'm responsible for, if they achieve their potential, whatever that might be, I can't do any better than that. So, you know, that's, I know I've said that to you before. I think I said that in our first show, but I absolutely firmly believe that the idea is to let people achieve their potential. Now, that doesn't mean telling them what to do, because I don't know every single person's potential. I've just got to create an environment by which they can actually achieve it. So I think that's the freedom thing that you're referring to, that if they understand the rules, that, you know, the things that they can't do, you know, you can't sign a check for $100,000, you know, you're not allowed to do that. So they don't. So there's got to be some sort of rules around things. But once you've set the limits, the boundary conditions, I think then you'll have to allow people to make choices within it. And I quite like the sort of idea. I sort of feel somebody has the best chance of achieving their potential if they're happy. And I know that sounds, you know, a little bit sort of loosey-goosey, but I do believe that if somebody's happy, then they perform at their best. And I really love that John Lennon quote. I don't know if you've heard it, but John Lennon is reputed to have said that he was told by his mum that the purpose of life was to be happy. So the thing that everybody should strive to achieve in their life is happiness. And he was at school and the teacher asked him what he wanted to be when he grew up. And he put his hand up and he said, happy. And the teacher said, you know, you don't understand the question. And he said, no, you just don't understand life. And I sort of firmly believe that is true of everybody. You know, that, you know, if people feel, to make you happy at work, you know, some people need to just feel safe and secure. They don't want their job to be under threat. And other people don't want to be, you know, micromanaged. And other people don't want to have to report every few minutes to someone or whatever it might be. But if you can just figure out what it is that allows somebody to be happy in their job, then I think that company can't do any better than that. And you know, you do have to have some rules, and I think that's management's job to make sure that those rules are in place. But I do fundamentally think it's about happiness.
Yeah, well, Daniel Pink talks about the need for autonomy. He talks about autonomy in the context of, doing exactly what you're talking about. You know, he says that people want to have a say in what they do, how they do it, when they do it, and with whom they do it. And that the problem that management has really is to get out of the way and just make sure that it becomes a results-oriented environment and not a time-oriented environment. And he gives a number of really, really interesting examples of case studies. And one of them was quite an old one with 3M, where I think the CEO, the big mucky muck, was a fellow called McKnight. And what he did, and this was, I think it was way back in the 1940s, he said that people could spend 15% of their time on their own projects. And I think he called it experimental doodling or something like this.
Yeah.
And people got really, really excited about this. Now, it drove the chief financial officers crazy because they started computing what it was costing the company to have all of their employees spending 15% of their time on other things. But then it was pointed out that, for example, the Post-it notes that are now ubiquitous were developed on that 15% time. And tons of things. Google has done the same thing. I understand that Gmail, Orchid, Google Talk, Google Sky, Google Translate were all born in a 20% time slot that was given to Google employees to develop their own stuff. And, you know, what Pink points out is that in that time, people are deciding what they do, how they do it, and with whom they do it. And the result is just phenomenal. I think it's amazing.
Yeah, I do. But I don't think you have to create that 15 or 20% time and say 85% of your time, you know, you do what you're told. And for 15 or 20%, you can be creative. Actually, I think you can create an environment where 100% of the time, people are able to share their good ideas and that something can happen with them. And I think that's my point about achieving potential. That, you know, you're absolutely right. If you don't tell people, if you don't constrain people, especially in a creative environment, if you don't constrain them, they will find opportunities to come up with new and creative things that will basically benefit your business. But I mean, of course, this is all predicated on the fact that people buy into the vision of the company. Because, you know, probably in 3M and probably in Google, people do. But if people don't buy into the vision of the company, so, you know, change the environment and make it a publicly traded bank, and people say, well, who's the beneficiary here? Is it a stockholder or is it the company? Are we doing something better for society? I think there has to be the leadership piece, the looking through the windshield piece. People have to buy into the philosophy of what that company stands for, and then they'll be creative. They'll find a way to get there. But if they don't buy into it, they won't. So, you know, there's a lot of potential in everybody, but the question is really how do you allow people to realize their potential?
No, that's exactly right. And I can just share one story with you that I think I might have shared before. But way back when I was with this architectural company, which will remain nameless, the economy had just tanked and we had to downsize. And I think at the time, it wasn't a huge company. I think we were about 130, but we had to lay off about 45 people. So it was decided in management's collective wisdom that somebody had to stand up in front of these 100 and so people and explain to them that we were downsizing and why. And although everybody pretty much knew it was going to happen, somebody had to stand up and tell them. So you'll never guess who was chosen to stand
up. Could that be you, Michael?
Yeah, it was me. And I have to say that it was the most difficult thing I'd ever done. And of course, I prepared notes, which I never looked at. But, you know, I told him the story, and the reason I'm going to tell you the story is that because what it did is it resulted in exactly what we're talking about here. I told him the story about, and I'm sure it's an apocryphal story, it's a story about how the Bushmen used to catch gorillas in Southwest Africa. Gorillas loved pumpkin seeds. So what the Bushmen would do is that they would take a couple of massive pumpkins, scoop out a hole the size of a fist in the top of the pumpkin, and put them on the top of a rock. And they would then hide in the bushes. And the gorillas would come, sit on the rock, grab the pumpkins, stick their hands into the pumpkins, and grab a handful of pumpkin seeds, such that when they tried to remove their hands, they couldn't because their hands were full of pumpkin seeds. So they had to either let go the pumpkin seeds and get their hand out of the pumpkin, or they would sit and look at the pumpkin, their hand in the pumpkin, not giving up the seeds. And of course, they chose not to give up any of the pumpkin seeds. And whereupon the bushman would sneak up behind him and whack him on the head, and that's how they would catch the gorillas. And the moral of the story is sometimes you have to let go in order to survive, you have to let go of some of the very things you like the very best. And what we had to do, I explained to them that day, is let go of some of the pumpkin seeds, some of the finest people that we could possibly ever wish to work with, because that was the only way that we could survive. But that if we could rebuild the business, we would have them all back, and we'd have those pumpkin seeds back. Anyway, I think it was well received, and people came up to me afterwards and sort of thanked me for doing it gently. But what emerged from that was something that I called an idea bank. And what I did is I said to people, look, why don't we do this? Why don't we split ourselves up into groups of four or five people with only one mid-level or senior person per group? And you guys go out and you figure out what we can do to develop the business. Think of new projects, think of new ideas, anything that we can do to help get those pumpkin seeds back, to get these guys back, get your buddies back. And I said to them, there are no rules, just go and do it. But by such and such a day, we have to gather, choose one of you to make a presentation to the whole firm, and tell the firm what you've come up with. And Steve, you have no idea the enthusiasm with which this was greeted and the absolute incredible quality of stuff that came out. And The only irony about this is that the only people who weren't that enthusiastic about this were the very senior folks, which sort of struck me as being interesting.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, when you were telling that story about the ideas bank, you know, the first thing that struck me is that where's the leadership? Because, you know, I think the leaders in a firm, their job in part is to see the market, is to see ahead. So if you keep, you know, with my analogy of driving a car, you know, the leader's job is to look ahead. There are futurists out there who try and look around the corner, you know, the bend ahead, and, you know, with various degrees of success. But leaders generally look at the road as far as you can reasonably see. And it's not a guessing game. I mean, the market, for most businesses, the market is pretty clear. Generally, the market's huge. It's full of power and momentum. It changes relatively slowly. You know, every now and again, there's a massive crash and it takes everybody by surprise. But even the last recession, you know, was incredibly well signposted. Most of us saw it coming long before it hit. It was only the degree of impact that was a surprise. Everybody knew that there was a recession coming. And now we're in a growth mode and everybody can see growth. You know, you can predict GDP, you know, pretty accurately for the next year. So the leader's job is to position the business in the marketplace and think about how the market's changing, how you can better serve your clients or whoever's buying your product or services. And it's not a guessing game. You know, there are some great examples. You know, Apple must be an amazing example of, you know, that they knew the same as everyone else that there was going to be a computer in every home and people were going to be carry around smartphones. But they, you know, they knew that exactly the same as everybody else who's in the technology space knew that. And so in your ideas bank, you know, I'd say, well, where were the leaders? You know, the leaders should be setting the framework, explaining where the market is, understanding what the opportunity is. And people should be working, yeah, the ideas bank should be within that framework of expectation and right direction. And that's when you really get the power of a company unleashed, because people buy into the vision, they come up with their own ideas that they can see that surround it, and you get that massive amount of enthusiasm behind the ideas. And then it's almost unstoppable. But, you know, how often do you see that in practice? There was a lack of leadership. There was management around, but not many leaders.
Okay, you don't have to be unkind now, Steve. And on that note, I think the first segment is is just about done. Incidentally, I think there may be a whole host of people who would agree with you there. Okay, we'll be right back.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
Tune in to Patricia Raskin Positive Living on VoiceAmerica.com every Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time and 11 a.m. Pacific Time. This program brings you practical and inspiring principles for living a more authentic, engaging, and passionate life. Patricia's guests will give you a formula for connecting, giving, forgiving, and miraculous living. So tune in and call in to Patricia Raskin Positive Living Mondays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time and 11 a.m. Pacific Time right here on the Voice America Variety Channel. It's practical, positive solutions for a happy, empowered, and successful life.
How do you achieve the utmost success in your life, career, faith, relationships, and more? It's all here in The Business of Living with host Scott Ventrella. Scott has experience as an executive coach, sought-after speaker, and lecturer. He and his guests will offer practical solutions and strategies to help you move to the next level of success, no matter where you are in your life and career. The Business of Living airs live every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Women can live their lives to the fullest and realize their dreams for growth and greatness. Georgine Summers knows. As host of On the Edge, Georgine will give you powerful tools and rules to help you change direction in your life and get rid of the fears that stop you from living your dreams. Stretch your boundaries and become the amazing person you've always wanted to be. On the Edge with Georgine Summers airs live every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
You are listening to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. To find out more about our program, please visit www.dreamersandwinners.com. Now, back to this week's program.
So welcome back to the second segment of that motivation thing. I decided after regrouping, after the first segment, that I had to lay a defense to the astonishing attack that was made on my lack of management and leadership skills by the good Commander Burroughs here.
Hello. Sorry, my phone's going, Michael.
I thought that I should just try and point out that the reason I raised the subject of the Idea Bank was not to highlight the deficiencies in my management and leadership styles or skills. Instead, it was to show how if you do give people the freedom to move and the freedom to think and the freedom to do their own thing on their own time in the way they want to with the people they want to, they can often come up with some really quite astonishing stuff. So rather than end this particular subject of the Idea Bank and leave you with the impression that I'm totally pathetic and useless as a leader or manager, I want to go back to the Idea Bank for just a second. I'd like to give you one example, and it was something that we had never thought of. So, for example, when the economy tanked, so many of these big stores had to close down. There were these big boxes that were vacant. And the question became, what were developers to do with these big empty boxes that were previously inhabited by Best Buy or whoever? I don't know, I'm making it up.
Yep.
And these guys came up with this idea, which I worked with you on a little bit, Steve, which was, look, why don't you put movie houses in those big boxes? And why don't we use clean energy as a means to fund some of the financial viability of this, if you like? And who knows? You know, the one thing we do know is that in a recession, the one industry that seems to remain relatively unscathed is the entertainment industry. So why don't we take something we know, which is the strength of the entertainment industry, and build movie houses? So, you know, as you know, we met with a guy who was in that business, and we met with you guys at Arup at that time talking about clean energy. And, well, it didn't work, but it was certainly worth spending some time looking at. And this was purely the idea of some very young guys scratching their heads, dreaming.
But when you started that explanation, you talked about management and leadership. I do think they're very separate things. You know, I think that the leader's job is that there are a very small number of leaders. And there's also a belief, I don't know what Daniel Pink says, but there's also a general belief that you can train a manager to manage, but you can't train a leader to lead. Leaders are sort of born and managers are sort of trained. And I see that, you know, a leader just has the ability to see ahead and to position the business, good and bad. The decision that you made to cut staff numbers, I'm sure wasn't made lightly, but the sooner you made that decision, the better for the business. So the further ahead you could see that coming and prepare for it and take action, the better it would be for your business. You know, it's difficult for the people always, but for the business, for the surviving group, you know, it's better to take those actions, always to take them quickly. And likewise, when the business is growing, you have to position yourself quickly. So the leader, for me, is, you know, an inspirational, positive person who can see ahead and can articulate that vision that everybody can get behind. Great leaders have, you know, lots and lots of positive attributes that I think you see consistently, whether you're talking about great political leaders, you know, talking about Nelson Mandela, or you're talking about great business leaders. They all seem to have certain things in common. So, you know, one is charisma. So you get leaders who people just generally like. I think leaders are generally positive. They're able to inspire people with their vision. And they don't create blame culture businesses. I actually think, you know, one of the most negative things you can have in any business is a blame culture. They allow people to fail. If you look at not having a blame culture, you say that's a company that has leadership, because they say everybody makes mistakes. If you're going to be creative, you're going to be close to the edge and you're going to get some things wrong. But as long as you fix it and you do it quickly and you do it for the client every single time, it's an opportunity to impress and to build a longer lasting, you know, relationship out of that mistake. So I think leaders have that ability, not just to inspire, but to create businesses where people can fail, and they fail with a safety net around them that gives them some degree of security and the ability to fail without ruining their career.
I would agree with you. You know, I think that people management is huge. And I was just struck in some of the businesses that I've run, I've found just it's sort of a strange atmosphere, in the sense that the senior people have been there forever, and they regard themselves as superior to everybody because they have been there forever. And then you have the young guys who are the real stars, and the older guys are always sort of looking over their shoulder. And for example, I've always been a great advocate of, whenever you have a problem that you need solved, to get the smartest people you can possibly find together in a room and just talk. And very often the smartest people in an organization are not the most senior ones. They're often the youngest ones. And I received tremendous resistance when I invited some young folks into some of these meetings, because they were seen as a threat. And I think it's very tough for leaders to create an environment in which people, the young guys and the old guys, can work together in an unthreatened kind of an atmosphere.
Yeah, I think the old-fashioned way of running businesses was through a pyramid organization. So, when I first started, I worked for a company called W.G. Curtin & Partners. And W.G. Curtin was Bill Curtin. It was his business. And we all worked for Bill. And Bill told us what to do. And he would tell me what my job was, and then I had to take my work to him and he would check it. And, you know, that's how the company ran. It was just pure pyramid. Bill was at the top, and, you know, we were all various degrees of somewhere in the organization. But you can't run a company like that at any scale. You know, there's just not enough bills to be able to do that. So modern large companies, and the firm I work for is now 32,000 people. I mean, how do you run a 32,000 person business through a pyramid system? It's impossible. These companies operate matrix systems, so people can be responsible. Well, there's a good thing and a bad thing about matrix organizational systems, which, and the way they work is, generally they have two axes. One is normally geography. So if you live in San Francisco, you're part of the San Francisco business. And then the second one is some other line of the business. that goes across the nation or even across the world. So you might be an expert in smartphones and you're in the, you know, the smartphone business, which exists in San Francisco, New York, London, Hong Kong, wherever it might be. And so you're connected in both directions, both geographically and by your area of interest. And I think that gives much more opportunity to people, especially as you're describing young people, to get involved in what they are expert at. And I think the best companies allow people to choose what they're interested in and to get involved both, you know, geographically and in their area of interest across the world. So I sort of believe in matrix management a bit like I believe that, you know, that some political systems are right. The devil is in the detail in how they operate. And I think that right now, I don't think there are many businesses that operate matrix organizational systems as effectively as they could. And actually, I think it's one of the big problems of very large companies right now is that they've got an organizational structure that should work, but they haven't quite figured out how to move from the pyramid to the matrix without feeling that the management and the leadership of the firm have lost control. And I think it's stifling a lot of large businesses.
Well, you know, Daniel Pink talks about control a lot in this book, and he talks about the danger of too much control. And he says that control is really a real problem that that these big companies have, because the more control that you are seeking to exert, the less autonomy that you're giving people, and it's the autonomy that results in growth and improved morale and happiness, if you like. And that he talks about the need for leaders to create an environment which is results-oriented. So people are rewarded for results, and they're not obliged to get there in any specific way. And, you know, just to get back to one other point that you were talking about, one of the really intriguing experiences that I had when I was the CEO of this architectural company is that that was sort of in the early days of clean energy,
yeah,
you know, of the green movement. So we had this incredible sort of dichotomy between the old guys who really did some of that stuff, but did it instinctively without really understanding the science behind it, and the really young guys who were totally turned on to the whole concept. And they had the real expertise, and their real challenge was to bring clean energy concepts in design to the senior guys who had never really thought of design in the same breath as clean energy. So the idea of configuring buildings to take advantage of the wind or the sun or whatever it may be hadn't really occurred to them. And the young guys were sitting there sort of biting their nails trying to find a tactful way to tell them that there should be other things they should be thinking of.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, you know, you're talking a bit about the building industry, and for me, the building industry is you know, a real dinosaur industry. You know, just as an example, a couple of years ago, I was at Turner's offices in Chicago. I think they'd just become a 100-year-old company, and they had a book on a coffee table book in the reception area of their offices. And while I was waiting for the guy I was meeting, I just had a look at the book, and inside the front cover, they had a fantastic photograph. I think it was their first project, and these guys were placing concrete, and they were, you know, they were there with wheelbarrows and concrete, and they were pouring it. Reinforcement was all over the place, and they were pouring the concrete amongst the reinforcement in this photograph. And when the guy came to meet me, I said, when was this taken? And he very proudly said, that's 100 years ago. And I said, wow, I thought it was yesterday. Because it just looks exactly the same, like a construction site around the corner. And you know, and I was obviously joking, but it was true. You know, he looked at it, and I said, apart from the wooden wheel on the wheelbarrow, it just looks like a site today, doesn't it? And it was absolutely, it was black and white, but it could have been a black and white photograph of today. So, you know, we're in an industry that hasn't changed very much. And so things have happened, like, you know, drawings used to be blueprints and done on film, and people would modify them. They would draw with ink, and they would scratch their errors out with razor blades and modify them with ink. And then computers came in, and we got computer programs, and people generally draw, they still produce two-dimensional drawings in a computer. Now, that's incredible. You know, why would you do that when you could do everything in three dimensions? It's now a model. It's not a drawing anymore. Why would you print it on a 2D piece of paper? But people do, because, you know, what has happened is we've taken the new technology and we've said, well, we must use it the same way we used ink on film, mustn't we? And of course, the answer is no. We should have a completely different process now for designing a building. But, you know, there's a case where, you know, I think the new technology has been implemented by the old management. And so what you get is a sort of weird combination of you know, what is possible, but you don't realize the potential of the new technology. And I think you could apply that to lots of different things. If you asked a 22-year-old to implement your new computer drawing system, I'm pretty sure somebody who'd never seen a 2D drawing, they wouldn't come up with that idea. They'd say, why don't we just have a virtual model? And why don't we give that to the builder? And then he can go, like a computer game, go inside and have a look at it, and he'll just build it in accordance with what's in the model. Because that just seems a very... Why print it in 2D and then build it in 3D when you started with a 3D model in the first place? Just seems so much like common sense. But I suspect, you know, we've been led down that path because we've tried to do things in the old way with new technology.
Yeah, but now, Steve, now I think you come back to square one, which is the whole issue of leadership, right? Because you need to have leaders in place who are prepared to listen to those young guys and say, you know, life has moved on, we need to change. And, you know, I think back, you know, to Nelson Mandela, and he talks about his earliest experiences in leadership. And he was told by the regent of the tribe that he was living with about that a leader is akin to somebody tending a flock, a shepherd. And that what you have to do is you have to set the direction, and then you have to let the young ones, the enthusiastic ones, go ahead and get the flock to where you want them to go. But you've got to let them be exuberant and excited and inventive. And of course, if they go off track, you've got to put them back on track. And if there's a problem, then you come from behind and fix it. But he said the key to leadership is to lead from behind. Now, we've all heard about, you know, leading from behind, and everybody has laughed at Obama when he said that we should lead from behind. But, you know, the actual, I think, derivation of that was something akin to Mandela, who said you have to give other people the credit for certain things. And the leader steps forward when there's a problem. But if good things happen, you have to give credit to others. And very often, it's the young people who race ahead and find a better way to the destination that should get credit. And I think a great leader is somebody who's prepared to do that. Now, I know, Steve, you're itching to reply, but unfortunately, it's the end of the segment. So let's continue this when we get back.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
Museums are great places to work and wonderful places to visit. But are they essential? How can we improve our museum practice so that museums remain vital and essential players in society? Listen for Museum Life with host Carol Bossert, where each week we'll discuss timely and topical issues of concern to the museum community. Museum Life can be heard live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Do the adventures of Indiana Jones leave you curious about this exotic and unusual profession? If so, don't miss Indiana Jones, Myth, Reality, and 21st Century Archaeology with Dr. Joseph Schuldenrein. You'll learn about forensics, ancient civilizations, and human origins. Listen to Dr. Schuldenrein and colleagues discuss their excavations and related archaeological topics, ranging from the unique to the sublime, and yes, even the mundane. Indiana Jones, Myth, Reality, and 21st Century Archaeology, live Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific Time, on Voice America Variety. Ah. A nice glass of wine is very refreshing after the end of a long day. But have you ever considered the story behind the wine? Tune in to Bacchus and Beery Wine Radio with your hosts, Roger and Donna Beery. You'll meet some of the people behind the world's wineries, travel the wine country, and learn more about that glass that you're enjoying. Roger and Donna will also give would-be vintners a behind-the-scenes look at starting a winery. Bacchus and Beery Wine Radio airs live every Friday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Voice America Variety.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
You are listening to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. To find out more about our program, please visit www.dreamersandwinners.com. Now, back to this week's program.
Welcome back to the third segment. And we ended the last segment talking about Nelson Mandela's idea of leading from behind. So why don't we just follow on from there?
It's funny, you made me think of something that happened to me a long time ago. So I was first put in a leadership position when I was pretty young. I was in my 20s. And the reason was my boss, he went on vacation and he had a stroke and he never came back to work, actually. And so the leader of the business asked me to take charge quite young. And I asked him about being a leader. And he said to me, there's two types of leaders. He said, you know, one is the General Custer type leader. He said, and you know, you see them all the time. He says, you know, they got flowing white hair and they're on a white horse and they charge out in front and they wave to everybody saying, follow me. And he said, that's a leader. You know, you see plenty of those around. But he said, when they go into battle, they probably get shot first. He said, they don't last very long. He said, and the other leader is the General Montgomery leader, who's all tactics. He's behind everybody, coming up with a vision and a plan, but letting everybody else go forward and take that plan forward. He said he always survives. And he said, you want to be more like the second leader than the first. And it sort of stuck with me for a long time. Not that I believe it's a game of war, but this idea of, you know, really you've got to come up with a strategic vision and plan and then let people go. And yes, you've got to change tactically as things happen, but you've got to give people the opportunity to do their things. And so that was my first point. And the second one was something else that you said. I think younger people coming up with great ideas, I think most companies have a means by which you can do that. I don't think the ideas, harvesting the ideas, is the problem. The problem is when somebody who's, you know, relatively young, say 5 years experience, comes up with a great idea, does the company have a system for getting something done with it? Because if somebody comes up with a great idea and then it just dies, they take it to their boss and their boss says, yeah, that's a good idea, I'll come back to you, and then never do. That person will never come up with another idea again. They'll never share their idea with the leadership ever again. You've got to actually do something with it. Even if it doesn't go anywhere, you've got to explain to people, this is what we did with that idea, this is where we took it, and this is where it sort of failed. They'll probably come back with a way to try and get past that roadblock. But you've got to have a process in which you can engage the person who generated the idea with some outcome, even if it's failure, so that they can learn from it. If you don't have a system for taking good ideas and turning them into something, it's a waste of time harvesting them in the first place.
No, I get it. And it's what's interesting about that is that it sort of touches upon something else we spoke about in one of the earlier shows I think it was collaboration. And we were talking about the importance of creating a collaborative environment where people felt comfortable sharing ideas and where failure wasn't seen as a failure, pointing out that, you know, any Nobel Prize winner that you could think of, any baseball player you could think of, has failed far more times than they've succeeded. But the key was to create a collaborative environment which allowed that to happen. And sort of leading off from that idea was this problem that a lot of people see in creating competitive environments where people within an organization are seen as competing with one another to get up the ladder, and how when you create a competitive environment, what that does effectively is it stifles collaboration. because you then see sharing an idea with a potential competitor as something that could really come back to haunt you.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And it's you know, business is everything you do in business is a team sport. So creating this idea of competitiveness, I mean, that comes back to if you've got a pyramid organizational system, then there are only a few people, you know, there are more people at the bottom and there are less people at the top by nature of it being a pyramid. And so it becomes incredibly competitive. But actually, the business succeeds by, it's like a piece of cloth. You know, a matrix management organizational system for me is like a piece of cloth. There's a weft and there's a weave. And, you know, the weft is the geographic locations and the weave are the things that apply in every single space. And when it works together, it's fantastic. You know, if you don't have both directions, it's just strands of cotton. But when you weave them together, you can do something amazing with it. And you've got to have the ability to be able to let people work in teams and reward them for success as a team. And I'm not talking about a bonus culture. I'm saying best businesses are meritocracies. So that the people who get to the top, they got there on merit. The people who get the highest pay, they get it on merit. The people do something great, they're rewarded for it. I think everybody can support meritocracy. What people can't do is to understand that somebody got to the top because they clambered over someone else.
Oh, that's right.
And that to me, that's really, you know, rather sort of negative culture. If you're incredibly competitive all of the time, whilst competition and competitive nature is good, you know, you really should be competitive to your competitors and not to your collaborators, which is your own colleagues.
Yeah, but that also comes back to leadership, I think. One of the things that I learned over the years was something that Nescafe captured. When I was running this music company, Nescafe was our global sponsor. And their tagline was this: one thing leads to another. The idea was get over, have a cup of coffee and talk, because one thing will lead to another. And I never, ever forgot that, because in my mind, what that led to was the fact there's no such thing as a crazy idea, because if that triggers another thought, which triggers another thought, which results in something fantastic, the person that came up with a crazy idea deserves as much credit as anyone for getting the ball rolling. And I think the great leaders are those that recognize the little guys in the back who aren't the most vocal, but who really do participate. I think it's really, really important.
Yeah, the Hewlett-Packard idea, and I don't know whether it exists online, but I remember somebody showing it me, is they looked at their ideas generation like a stream. And they were saying, you know, people can put things in the stream. The stream flows, and it flows to a product. So the end, you know, the end result, where the stream meets the river meets the sea, is where you meet, the company meets the market. So the ideas are put in and they all flow in one direction, but they flow past all of the different parts of the business. And everybody can contribute to that idea. That stream of knowledge is added to over time. And I really like that as a sort of concept of building on ideas. You know, it's going somewhere, so it's heading out to the marketplace. And the idea is being enriched by the different parts of the business as it goes along. And yes, some of them fail, but you could see what was happening to your idea all the way through the process. And I think that being involved, you know, there's nothing worse than somebody, you know, we had our holiday party last Saturday night, and you know, I was talking to somebody, and they, even at the holiday party, they had an idea and they came and spoke to me and said, you know, I've been thinking about this, and it was an interesting idea. But I really came away Saturday night thinking, I've got to do something with that. I have a place where I keep ideas. And every now and again, I go back and read the ideas, things that I've forgotten that happened a long time ago as well. And I go back through my list. And I added it immediately. And I started to think, what could I do with that idea? And, you know, how could I get that person engaged in making that something real? That was important enough for somebody to say, I'm going to share that with my boss. And I'm going to, you know, it's like a gift, like the whole idea of this show, somebody giving me a gift, which is their thought. And they've trusted me with that and said, you know, I'd like you to do something with it. I trust you with my gift. And now the obligation is on me. And I think that's how you've got to think about these things if you're going to make them real.
You know, I think the really profound thing that comes out of what you've just said is the real importance of conveying to people around you that you are listening. Whether or not anything comes of it is another story completely. But I just found over the years exactly what you've just described, is that if people believe that you really are listening to them, and having listened to them, you're not going to just ignore them, that's a huge motivating factor in getting people to keep going and to stay loyal. And, you know, my feeling over the years has been that, you know, we've all dealt with, you know, chief financial officers and bean counters. We all know how they think. I mean, they all look at time and they look to see what the return on investment is on an amount of time that's being put in. But in my experience, what many of them never do is they never look at the cost of replacing an employee that you've spent years and years hiring and integrating into your business. That cost is enormous. So yep. You're far better off investing time in keeping somebody happy, even though there may not be a direct return on investment in doing that. It's a massive return on investment, in my mind, huge.
Yeah, I mean, we all say in the service industry, we all say that people are our greatest asset. It's a very easy thing to say. It rolls off the tongue, and we really believe it. But we have to treat people as the greatest asset. It's no good if you say that and you believe it and then you don't do anything about it.
That's right.
That you know, somebody who knows the company and knows, has knowledge and relationships and a network internally is important, because it costs money to recreate that. So, you know, there's a value to that asset, and you've got to treat it with care. I would say, though, that you know, we're talking about very positively about every idea is a good idea. I don't think every idea is a good idea. There are some, you know, people come up with some terrible ideas. You know, maybe that's in my opinion, or maybe they really are terrible ideas. I also think people value when they come up with something that really is, you know, hopeless, it just really is going absolutely nowhere at all. You do them the honest service of telling them that and why. Because I think it's also easy to imagine that business is this sort of beautiful flowery garden, that everything is wonderful and the sun always shines and every idea is a great idea and just got to find some way to do something with it. I think people, when they offer you a thought, something that they've really been thinking about that they believe has got some mileage, that if you sit down and think about it, and you've got to listen, as you say, and you've got to consider, but then if it really is not, if you're not going to do anything with it, you are obliged to go back and give them the respect of explaining why that idea is not going to progress. Maybe it's the wrong time. Maybe it's a bad idea, whatever it might be. You know, I think people they want to feel valued and they want to get respect and recognition that they deserve in the business, but they also deserve the truth. And I think a lot of bad leaders or bad managers don't deal with poor performance. They don't deal with telling people when they've made a mistake that they shouldn't have done, and they don't tell people when they come up with a bad idea that it really isn't going to go anywhere. And there's nothing worse than, you know, you share what you think's a good idea, hear nothing, and you think nobody cares, and it's much better to be told the truth. And I don't think that's done enough.
No, look, I agree with you, but there's a rider to that as well, and it has to be done constructively.
Yes.
There's something constructive you can take out of any idea that you get. And frankly, from my perspective, the mere fact that somebody has come forward with an idea is itself totally constructive. I mean, you're right, not all ideas are good. But let me just move to another subject just briefly, because it's a subject that's near and dear to me and that I think a lot of service companies fall into this trap. And we can learn a great deal from lawyers. So lawyers and some other service companies bill on an hourly basis. And while that might make business sense to them, I believe that it totally undermines motivation on many different levels, and it also doesn't do the clients much of a service. So if you're being judged based on the amount of billable hours that you put in, even if your work is perfect and you manage to perform the work quicker than your colleagues, they are going to advance above you in the pecking order because they're putting in more billable hours. So what possible incentive is there for you to be efficient and work quickly? And that's, I think, is a terrible situation to create, and it doesn't serve anyone's interest. It becomes almost a disincentive to working quickly and efficiently. It's crazy.
Yeah, I think as you made me laugh there, Michael, because learning from lawyers, that would be a great show. and I've got a lawyer joke for you based on what you just described. So this lawyer dies and goes to heaven. So that's a tough start to a joke, isn't it? And he goes to heaven. And when he arrives at the pearly gates, there's a huge band, about 500 people, and they're playing music. It's like a Mardi Gras. And St. Peter's there, and he walks through the gates, and he can't believe that, you know, all these people are all shouting his name and waving flags, and he, you know, they're really excited. And so he says to St. Peter, he said, "Wow, this is absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much. But, I mean, do you do this for everybody who arrives?" And St. Peter said, No, just you. Because you're the oldest person we've ever had in heaven." And the guy said, "But really?" He said, "I'm only 77. And St. Peter gets some paper out of his pocket and says, "But not according to your timesheets."
Many a truth told in jest. Well, sadly, Steve, we've come to the end of this week's show. But I thought before we end, let me just summarize quickly. It seems to me that this whole issue of motivating people comes down to making sure that the people we're motivating are happy and that they have some level of autonomy and that they really feel that they are being listened to. And while that sounds simplistic, perhaps, I think it's quite profound. And if in the process our management style doesn't stifle their creativity and enthusiasm, we're doing good. And I think we'd all do well to heed Daniel Pink's advice and to pay attention to the latest studies on motivation and to see how intrinsic motivators really work much better than extrinsic ones. Well, Steve, again, thanks so much for the time. I really can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
We will continue this at another time, and it's always fun.
Yeah, definitely. Take care. Look after yourself.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
All right. See you soon. Bye.
As for our show next week, I thought I'd take advantage of Steve's availability and enthusiasm for these conversations and talk to him about ethics, which is a subject that is near and dear to both of us. So until next week, see you then.
Thank you for tuning in to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. Please join us again next Monday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Until then, Michael encourages you to keep daring to dream and to remember what Nelson Mandela once wrote, namely that a winner is a dreamer who never gives up.